Welcome to The Week in Geek on GeekWire. I'm Todd Bishop, GeekWire editor.
I'm Monica Nicholsberg, GeekWire civic innovation editor.
And I'm John Cook, GeekWire co-founder.
All right, we have a lot to talk about this week. We're going to give you a quick preview of the GeekWire Summit, and we're going to talk about what we discovered about Google's Nest from a public records request we made to the University of Washington. And we will be breaking down and explaining what the heck Jeff Bezos is doing with his $2 billion. All that and more coming up this week on The Week in Geek on GeekWire. All right, John, this is crunch time. We were lucky to even get you into this room.
Barely keeping the head above water, Todd.
Given everything that's going on, first off, you're about to head off to an event tonight called The Playbook, where you're interviewing Mark Mader, the CEO of Smartsheet.
Yeah, I'm excited about this. This is a new speaker series we're doing where we're sitting down with entrepreneurs, startup leaders, and we're getting into the nuts and bolts of really building businesses and culture. And I love these. We did this with Adrian and Nick Hanauer to kick off the event earlier this year, and now with Mark Mader of Smartsheet. It's going to be really fun, I hope.
That's right. So by the time people hear this...
But you can't come out for that one because it'll be done by the time people hear this.
It's in the past.
That's right.
So you can watch the video. I assume we're going to have that on GeekWire.
We will. That's what I was going to tout. So be sure to check that out. And I assume that at some point in the future, we'll have similar meetups, if not under the Playbook rubric, then at least under some other similar event style.
It's been really fun because it's kind of getting back to some of the roots of GeekWire of sitting down and having really in-depth and substantive conversations with startup CEOs and founders and really getting into the nitty gritty. I love it.
Speaking of really in-depth conversations, Monica, you are going to be talking with somebody really interesting at the upcoming GeekWire Summit, which is on October 2nd and 3rd in Seattle. Who are you interviewing there?
I'm going to be chatting with Tony West, the chief legal officer at Uber, who is just a really interesting guy. Obviously, Uber has had a legally challenging year, and we'll be getting into that, but also looking ahead at a potential IPO and also talking about some of the interesting connections he has.
Whoa, interesting connections, like family connections?
Yes. So
that's a teaser.
Oh, should we keep it a surprise?
Maybe.
All right.
Yes.
So to find out more,
that's right.
come to the summit.
Yeah, I think that's going to be a great conversation. I'm really excited to have Tony there because Uber is such an interesting company as it tries to transform transportation. And historically, their mode of operation was, let's break all the rules and not worry about anything. And now with Dara Khosrowshahi, the new CEO who's come into Uber, and Tony West, who is a new recruit as well, they're really trying to reposition the culture of the company to kind of this new chapter for Uber. So I think that's going to be a great discussion. See if they can do that.
There are a couple of ways that this is really Uber 2.0. One of them, like you said, is rebooting under a much more statesmanly CEO. And he brought in Tony as one of his first recruits. Tony was actually previously a DOJ lawyer under the Obama administration.
And worked at PepsiCo, I think, as well, right?
Right. Yeah. He did, yeah. But then there's also this whole other aspect of it where they're kind of changing their business model. They're really doubling down on micromobility, like shared electric bicycles. They're moving into scooters. They're incorporating competitors into their app because they really want to be this on-demand service for transportation. And that combined with the potential for an IPO, I think opens up this great conversation about what is next for this company that so far has been acting like sort of a rebellious teenager.
Yeah, that's great. And he's just one of the speakers we have. Also Sue Desmond-Hellman from the Gates Foundation, the CEO, Reggie Fils-Aimé, who is the president of Nintendo of America. We had a great prep call with him, and he is going to be the classic Reggie from everything I can tell, and others.
Yeah, a lot of other great speakers, Redfin CEO Glenn Kelman. I'm also excited about some of the special touches we have. Of course, we have some great parties tied into the summit, but some sessions like Inventions We Love with really cool startup inventions, and the culmination of the GeekWire elevator pitch, startup pitch competition will happen October 2nd at the summit too. So that's going to be really fun to see who wins this thing.
Who is it? Do you know already?
No, it'll happen live on stage. You'll get to participate, Monica, and cast your ballot.
Yeah, and I have to tell you, one of the cool things about doing this event, which is our biggest event of the year, is that we get to get a little sneak peek in the prep calls. And I have to tell you, there is a sleeper hit that I've heard in terms of the top session at this year's
event.
I think
I know what it is because you came off the conference call pretty jazzed up.
Yeah, Jesse Woolley Wilson, the CEO of Dreambox Learning, she is amazing. And it's going to be fantastic to hear about the future of learning, which is not just about K through 12 classrooms. It's about how all of us learn and absorb information and improve ourselves. And it's changing, and tech is playing a huge role, and she has some fascinating insights into that. So that is the GeekWire Summit. It's coming up October 1st through 3rd. The main content days are the 2nd and 3rd in Seattle. You can find out more and get tickets at geekwire.com/summit. Now, one of the biggest news stories of the week was one that I was working on, John, for more than a year. You got the original scoop on this. Nat Levy on our team did a fantastic job of pulling it all together. Let me explain what this is.
We get excited about it in these journalism circles, yeah, but I think it's a great story.
It is. We've discovered plans by Nest, the Google company, to get into digital health. Nest, of course, was originally known for its smart thermostat, and they've since moved into other areas of
smart thermometer.
No, not a smart one.
Oh, there you go. Help.
That's funny. Yeah. There you go, John. I wasn't even thinking that direction. That would have been a great lead on the story. Nest, hey, the company. Anyway,
I do my part.
So they obviously are known for these consumer electronics and devices that you use in your home, but they have been looking very seriously at getting into digital health. And we know this because a public records request that we made to the University of Washington that GeekWire submitted more than a year ago.
It really was more than a year ago?
It was at this point, yeah.
And we were persistent on asking about these records that never showed up.
So we broke the news a year ago that Google had acquired Synosis Health, which is a company that had spun out of the University of Washington. And because of that, the acquisition papers were part of the University of Washington record. And that those are the documents we finally got after a year of requesting them. And it turns out that it wasn't Google writ large that acquired Synosis. It was actually Nest as a part of Google, or at least an affiliate or connection, sister company to Google, that made the acquisition, which is fascinating because it did reveal that Nest is interested in getting into digital health, which had not been revealed in this level of specificity before. So that was interesting. But the fascinating thing reading through the documents was the...
How many pages?
Oh, I think it was more than 1,500 pages of documents. And that included contracts and licensing agreements. So not all of it was as juicy as some of the other parts. But the internal emails, the folks at the University of Washington actually struggled with just how private Nest and Google wanted to be, because they did not want Nest's plans to become public. And they actually have never even made a public press release about this. We basically, John, you got the tip last year and we broke the story based on that inside information, but no one else has ever said anything about this publicly other than citing our report.
As far as Google's concerned, this didn't happen, right?
Exactly. Exactly. But it's fascinating in part because this is the latest in a series of startups founded by Shwetik Patel, who is the MacArthur genius who is involved in all sorts of sensors and interesting algorithms at the University of Washington. He's a professor there and has done work with his students that has resulted in a number of different startups, and this is just the latest.
Well, one of the controversies tied to this, that's a little bit of the backstory that I don't know if it even comes out in the docs. It kind of does. It's kind of subtle. But if you read between the lines, the part of this that I've heard was that there was a bit of a disconnect between the founders and some of the managers in terms of how big Synosis could get and whether they should go the path of an acquisition or just continue to build this company into something that was a standalone on its own, which is a classic dilemma for entrepreneurs. You know, do you take the easy – well, not an easy, but do you take an early acquisition and do pretty well, or do you – you know, turn Nest and Google off and try to build something even bigger? And there was a little bit of an internal struggle there with this deal from what I've heard.
You know what I call this? I call this the Kenny Rogers dilemma. You know why?
Kenny Rogers.
Yeah, because you got to know when to hold them. You got to know when to hold them and you got to know when to fold them. And in this case, there was a contingent of veteran entrepreneurs involved with Synosis who wanted to hold them and wanted to keep playing this hand and see how far they could get and not fold their cards.
So what does this actually mean for consumers? I know that the backstory of this is super interesting and all of the sort of behind the scenes mergers and acquisition stuff. But if I'm just an everyday person, how does Google Nest, which I just think of as making smart thermostats, get into health, and what does it mean for me?
Well, when I'm smoking my cigarette in my house and I light my house on fire, not only is Nest going to be able to alert me of that, they're going to be able to provide me health ideas and remedies to solve me from getting lung cancer later down the path.
Do you really feel like the smoke detector can be that improved upon?
This is why John is no longer on the show as much. I think this is interesting in two different ways. One, you've had this wave of tech companies get into health, and it was clear that Google was very interested and is pursuing its own initiatives. But I think it's interesting that Nest in particular is headed in this direction, because this is a company that's known for taking things that are kind of wonky and complicated and kind of a pain in the butt, like a smoke detector, and making it simple and easy and something that actually can be worked with, you know, wave your hand over the smoke detector, or actually just tell the thermostat to work at a certain time of day and it turns on, and it's simple, like a consumer electronics device. If they can bring that approach to health, I think that's a good
thing. But do you think it's digital health in the home, or do you think it's digital health? Because some of the Sonosis products, I think, were more like remote health monitoring. So using a mobile device to detect some sort of disease. So a doctor would use it, not a consumer, right?
No. Well, the thing is, they were medical grade technologies on your smartphone. So you could use them in the field, or you could use them on yourself to detect different things about your breathing, your heart rate, that might indicate problems that you might want to go see a doctor about. So here's a good example. There was one called Spiro Smart. This was an app, and they essentially used the built-in microphone on the phone to measure lung function. So it used different sensors on the phone to replicate the effect of high caliber, high quality kind of medical equipment. Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. So that was the whole idea. It was sensors and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I guess that gets back to my point that the product was geared towards, I thought, more towards medical professionals more so than consumers. But who knows? It never really
got out into the market.
Got out in the market in a big way. So it could probably go either direction.
If it is to consumers, I can see this being kind of a headache for doctors, because I'm just picturing WebMD on steroids. You know, like you type in your symptoms and they're like, could be a headache, could be cancer.
Yeah. Hopefully it's a little bit more precise than that.
But can't you see people who have their constant monitoring app or product on their phone, and they are, you know, maybe are naturally a hypochondriac going in for every little thing?
Well, this does tie back into the GeekWire Summit, where we're actually having a track at the summit this year on health tech, and we're going to dive into this, and it's the whole intersection of AI and health. And so you're starting to get into these questions. Would this AI system potentially be adequate or perhaps even better than what a doctor can provide?
I'm skeptical.
Yeah. Another example, use the smartphone camera to basically detect jaundice in newborns. And that really is Shwetik Patel's magic, really. He's figured out ways to use sensors that are around us in the world to do interesting things. Like, he used the wiring in the house as an antenna for one of his technologies. So yeah, lots of interesting stuff. And really, as you're saying, Monica, big implications for the way we could use health and health technology in our everyday lives. All right. We will link to that story and to the GeekWire Summit from the show notes on this episode on geekwire.com. Coming up around the corner, what the heck is Jeff Bezos doing with his $2 billion? We'll explain it coming up next on GeekWire. Welcome back to The Week in Geek. It's Todd Bishop,
Monica Nicholsberg,
and John Cook.
We recorded last week's episode too early to get this news in. Jeff Bezos had a huge announcement that we'd actually been anticipating quite a bit here on GeekWire. We had a story about it, previewing it just a couple days before it happened. He is committing $2 billion to what he's calling the new Day One Fund. This is an effort to target both homelessness and preschool education, to improve the situations in both of those categories. John, you had an interesting commentary on this whole topic, really drawing from the Amazon leadership principles and how they relate to what Jeff Bezos is doing here. And the key phrase is, the child will be the customer. This is referring to the preschool initiative. Why does that matter? Why did you key in on that?
Well, I think it does speak to Bezos taking a new approach as it relates to his philanthropy. I think if we've learned anything about Jeff Bezos and how he's built Amazon is that he likes to do things in his own manner and with his own style and with a relentless focus on the customer. And I think he's going to apply those same principles to what he does in philanthropy. So that was interesting to me. And we'll see where he goes with it.
I keyed in on that too, because it's such a strange phrase and you know that he chose it on purpose. He doesn't do anything not on purpose, but it seems so likely to create a negative reaction because not everything, particularly children, are subject to market dynamics. And I don't know. I was just puzzled by that. I felt like it was almost a like tongue in cheek or that he had to know that people were going to react to that in a way that said like, you can't just apply this kind of merciless business mentality to the education of young people.
Interesting. Yeah, I look at it more as he's looking at it with fresh eyes. I think that I actually, would you send your kid to a school to a preschool run by Jeff Bezos and team?
No, I'd rather send my son to LeBron School in Akron.
Is there such a thing?
You don't know about LeBron James School in Akron, Ohio?
No, I don't.
Oh my gosh.
Oh, sorry.
This is a major thing, Todd. You've been out of the loop.
Come on.
LeBron James has started this really innovative STEM-oriented school in Akron with the support of University of Akron. He's bankrolling this entire project. It's extremely innovative, really creative. Next time I'm back in Ohio, I might go check it out. So I'd rather have him go to LeBron School.
Why?
I don't know. I like LeBron.
We should also note that like LeBron School, the preschools that Bezos is planning to build are going to be tuition free. And he says that they'll be in under-resourced neighborhoods. So, I mean, I don't mean to say it's not a good thing to do. And they're going to be Montessori inspired, which has shown to be a pretty successful method. I just thought the language of the announcement was sort of curious.
Well, the whole PR effort around it was curious from the very beginning, because you got to remember this started a year ago with him making a call out on Twitter saying, hey, I need all your ideas. Where should I put all my money? I'm not sure where to spend my billions when it comes to philanthropy, which is a little bit of an oddball approach because I would think typically with philanthropy, you have stuff you're passionate about that you should care about, right? That's where you're – I mean, it's not like the wisdom of the crowds drives you into the thing that you're passionate about and what you want to do. So the whole thing was a little weird in terms of the PR effort. Frankly, it ties back into the whole Amazon HQ2 effort. You know, this is kind of like bidding and tell me your ideas and competition off one another. And that rubbed people the wrong way too. And so the whole PR effort around it was a little different.
Yeah, I think from his perspective, he's already doing the good work for society.
In his perspective, correct, yes.
That he is passionate about through Blue Origin, his rocket company.
Or Amazon, by providing jobs to people.
True, but I think in terms of that fire and passion that should inform how billionaires spend their money, I think that Blue Origin is very much that. You know, he's always been super interested in space exploration, and he believes that by creating the infrastructure to move industry off of this planet, we can preserve it. And he thinks that that actually is in service of a higher good, even if it is a for-profit venture.
That is true, and that is interesting. And you got to wonder if just the PR effort here that Bezos's hand was kind of forced a little bit, because a lot of people have pushed back against this idea of this huge investment into space as whether that is benefiting society or not. Now, Bezos is making the argument that it is, but a lot of people don't believe that and think that there are immediate problems that need solved on Earth. And I think Bezos is, in my opinion, at this really interesting crossroads where he's kind of unexpectedly become the richest person on the planet, and he has a much higher profile, and he's getting out there in a much more public way, and he's trying to shape his, not his legacy because it's too early for that, but his position in society and how he is viewed. And I think that is becoming more and more important to him. And I think this was an effort to do that. I think if he was going on along his way, he probably would have kept building Amazon for the next 10 years, and because it's still day one, and got and done Blue Origin for the next 10 years and see if he could get people traveling in space. And he'd probably been super happy with that. But the external realities around him, I think, pushed him into this direction.
To underscore that point, John, there was a 2010 interview that Jeff Bezos did with Charlie Rose, and he said, quote, I'm convinced that in many cases, for-profit models improve the world more than philanthropy models if they can be made to work. I mean, that to me is the true Jeff Bezos philosophy coming through. And I agree with you. I think that perhaps he's matured and come to realize the benefits. But I think the fact that he became the richest person in the history of the universe this past year created a lot of public pressure and caused this to happen.
Yeah, and it's reflected in his history, too. You know, you look at Blue Origin, and it's so consistent. Like, even when he talks about his childhood, it almost seemed like it was always building to this place. But then his philanthropic giving over the years, it's sort of sporadic. There's not really a unified theme that carries through. You know, he gave $2.5 million to the campaign to legalize same-sex marriage in Washington. He just gave another $10 million to a nonpartisan committee to elect veterans to Congress. But there isn't really a driving, cohesive passion like you might see from a Bill Gates with global poverty.
His family foundation, which I believe is run by his mom, essentially, they made a giant donation to the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center to create a new immunotherapy center. So there's been a lot of effort and a lot of money, but $2 billion is on a whole other scale. So,
there were arguments that it was pretty small in comparison to his overall net worth.
1.25%. I did the calculation on that if you take that out.
And there was a news organization that broke it down in terms of that amount of giving compared to what the average American gives. And I think it was either in line or less. But the thing to think about is, I mean, he is just getting started. So I think you got to give him a little bit of the benefit of the doubt, you know, on this.
On the other hand, the Gates Foundation launched with $20 billion. And that was in...
True, but I think there was more infrastructure and support around what the Gates Foundation was setting out to do. I don't think... And again, this speaks to my point that I think Bezos' hand was forced a little bit here, that he kind of had to do something. And so he's going in a little bit slower. First, I think with the Gates Foundation, there you had Bill Gates Sr. and you had Melinda Gates, who were definitely on board. And you had Bill Gates, who was really starting to move in that direction. And so there was a lot of momentum towards it. I don't get the sense that there's as much momentum towards Bezos moving into the philanthropic world. I think he wants to do Blue Origin and Amazon.
I will say the thing that struck me most about the entire announcement was that his new philanthropy's involvement with the issue of homelessness is much more arm's length. He's going to be picking and giving money to existing organizations. The preschool initiative, looking for new ways to educate kids, that's hands-on. In fact, he used the phrase during one of his interviews right afterward about, he said, I will operate this. And I think he was meaning like I as in my team and I.
The royal I.
Yes, the royal I. But I think that's notable. And I think that's where his passion probably lies more than on the homeless family issue. Maybe that's reading too much into it.
Well, it gets into this bigger issue of what the next chapter for Jeff Bezos is going to be and what is he going to do? I mean, is he going to move away from the day-to-day operation of Amazon in the next 10 years? And if so, what is he going to do? I mean, is he going to go and launch rockets down in Texas? Is he going to be involved in the Washington Post more? Is he going to be involved in the philanthropic, a mix of all these? I mean, the amount of money we're talking about in the net worth here, which is larger than many countries, is worth watching, like what a full country is going to do. And it's going to be fascinating to see which direction he goes.
One of the key questions is where this new preschool operation will be based, where it will be headquartered. And I think that will have a lot to do with where HQ2 ends up. But to your point, John, I think that Jeff Bezos will relinquish the title of CEO and become chairman sooner than many people expect. And I've been picking up on little clues here and there.
I think so, too. I would agree with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there
are things going on, even minor things like him being more active on Twitter, you know, the nonprofit effort. There are clues that would lead you to go down that path. And the designation of Andy Jassy as CEO of AWS and Jeff Wilkie as CEO of the consumer business – he's already kind of put in place the two very experienced CEOs who've been with the company for a long time. So there's a, seems like there's infrastructure in place to support this decision too.
I would not be completely shocked to see an announcement along these lines concurrent with the HQ2 unveiling.
Wow. Now that would be interesting.
I don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah, I know. We've debated. Monica and I have been debating
possible.
This.
I think it's possible. I do agree with your assessment that it's sooner in history than later.
Yeah. What are the odds that HQ2 is Pittsburgh, your other hope?
Slim.
And he announces resignation. There should be like a prize for that double win.
Well, resignation.
Yeah, resignation. Sounds
resignation's
like,
not the right.
Resignation sounds like something bad
retirement?
Is happening.
Yeah, we need to. Yeah, yeah. It's a transition.
Yeah.
Transition to his role as chairman. I think that's. And he already is chairman and CEO and founder. And I think it makes total sense for him to be founder and chairman. Very similar to the transition that Bill Gates made, although Gates did that as chief software architect for a while.
I can't remember where I read this, but it was like breaking down how Bezos manages his day. Did you see this?
No.
And like how he schedules like most of his most important meetings at 10 a.m.
I missed this.
Oh, we got to find where this was. Okay. And like by 5 o'clock, he's kind of done. It was really interesting breakdown of like how he segments his day.
Very interesting. Okay, we'll have to look that
up. I
don't
know. I just bring it up in terms of how he's thinking about his post-career, you know, post-Amazon life.
Do you think he's segmented his life in the same way? In other words, he knows, okay, this is the year when I'll retire and quote, move on?
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know that.
Okay.
All right.
We will be right back with the Random Channel. You're listening to The Week in Geek on GeekWire. Welcome back to The Week in Geek. It is time for the Random Channel, that moment of the show where we talk about all the random items we were buzzing about behind the scenes here at GeekWire this week. We weren't so much buzzing about this one this week, but I have to say, I was just completely sucked into the whole debate over the U.S. Open and Serena Williams.
Oh, you know, I didn't really follow this. I'm a pretty big tennis fan, too. I just have been too busy.
But the item that caught my attention this past week was an analysis by the New York Times, basically fact-checking the assertions that Serena Williams was making writ large based on the actual data about penalties at the Grand Slam tennis tournaments. So I don't know if everybody followed this. So Serena Williams, I thought she got a really raw deal in this whole thing, by the way. And I have to say, I played probably millions of hours of tennis as a kid. I played in lots of tournaments. Tennis is my game. Like as much as tennis and basketball were my two things, but like tennis was my passion growing up. Watching her at the U.S. Open, I thought she was just treated completely unfairly. So I want to say that at the outset. Her contention was that she, ultimately, one of her arguments was that she was penalized for saying something to the chair umpire. Not the referee. The chair umpire, by the way, is not the referee, despite what everybody on all the talk shows is saying. This total rant here, but like you can tell when people talk about things that they don't follow the sport. It was the chair umpire. And then the referee came out. All right. Just I want to establish this.
Established.
Very important to me. Anyway, so when she was arguing with the chair umpire, she said she called him a thief. And her contention was that she was penalized for saying that, but a man wouldn't have been.
Was it just that or was it a few other things?
That built up. First, she was penalized for coaching and for being coached from the stands. And her contention was that she shouldn't have been penalized for that. She didn't even see her coach do that. And by the way, she doesn't cheat. So that was the warning.
Who needs coaching in tennis anyway? I think that's the biggest joke.
I agree. Anyway, that was the warning. And then I believe she got the...
Especially Serena.
Right. The
yeah,
point,
she's good.
Yeah. The point penalty she got for smashing her racket, if I remember correctly. And then I don't think she realized that she had escalated up to the ladder to that extent. And I think that she thought that maybe the chair umpire had conceded the fact that she hadn't been coached. So at any rate, when she called him a thief, she was penalized a game in the deciding set of the U.S. Open final. I mean, it was ridiculous. The chair umpires should have exercised more discretion. At any rate, back to my original point, the New York Times story found that, in fact, men are penalized more for all sorts of things.
In tennis?
In tennis.
Or just life in general? In tennis. I think it's in life in general,
oh,
frankly.
Oh, jeez. Oh, that is, no, that is, that was John Cook, by the way.
And we do not endorse this message.
I was thinking more about like incarceration rates. I'm guessing, I don't have the fact in front of me, but I'm guessing they're higher for men than women. But
somebody fact check
me on that.
Yeah,
I'm just thinking,
I'll have to look up Steve Ballmer's USA Facts.
Now, that might not be penalized. I mean they're malcontents. Yes.
Well, so in almost all categories from 1998 to 2018, everything from racket abuse to audible obscenity to unsportsmanlike conduct, in almost all categories.
What year did you start with?
1998 to 2018.
Oh, I was going
to
say, so you're not even back into the Johnny Mack era of tennis.
In every area except coaching, interestingly, men are fined more than women. Now, that is interesting. I don't know why that would be the case. Maybe there's some weird psychology happening there.
There is some weird psychology.
At any rate, I thought it was, I appreciated the story because it took, I'm always looking these days for things that take anecdote and emotion and go out and find
science
and
data.
Determine whether it's actually true.
We need to find more stories like that on GeekWire.
We absolutely do. And it's, I really love the model that the New York Times followed here. For anybody who's looking for the story, the headline is, "Are Women Penalized More Than Men in Tennis? Data on Fines Says No." So that's me.
That's fascinating. I'm surprised that wasn't discussed more because I actually did read a lot about this, not because I care at all about tennis, but because I was interested in this idea of women and men being treated differently, especially because of so much stuff that I've been hearing about the Seattle Storm. Like there was I think in Eastern Washington, a bar where every TV had football playing and it was the Storm Championships. And somebody who was a partner of one of the players was denied her request to put the Storm on one of the TVs because football was on.
Now, that always frosts me if you're in the city where there's – because, you know, I'm a soccer fan and soccer often gets pushed to the side too. But if you're in a city where your team is playing, I don't care what sport it is, that sport should be on TV, especially a championship game.
I mean, I agree with that, but I think more egregious is this idea that women's sports are just not as interesting as men's.
Does that hold true in tennis, though? I think women's tennis is actually
better,
more popular than men's.
I think that the women's tennis matches are far more interesting to watch because you can see like for me as somebody who loves and plays tennis, I can see the perfect form on the backhand. I personally get a lot more intrinsic value and actually learn a lot more watching the women's game and the strategy that goes into it than just these guys out there just slamming the ball back and forth at each other. I mean, I realize we're getting into all sorts of gender stereotypes, but, you know, I like, you know, Novak Djokovic and he's great. And Roger Federer is a god as far as I'm concerned. But apart from that, if it's just two random professional men's players and two random professional women's players, I would always watch the women's matches because I know it's just going to be better technically. And I'm going to appreciate it as somebody who loves tennis more. That's where I am. Sorry, we're probably going to get tons of hate mail on this because we are dealing in stereotypes here to some extent. That said, you know, that's my
opinion. Your random chance.
But,
okay,
I mean, how else are you supposed to have these conversations when the things themselves are inherently gendered?
Yeah, then they're split. That's true. You can't really talk about men's and women's tennis without
there isn't any mixed tennis, right?
Sure. Yeah, mixed doubles.
Oh, there is?
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, what do I know?
Yeah. So at any rate, if you go back, Serena's gotten a raw deal throughout the U.S. Open, like dating back to Jennifer Capriati, who was amazing.
Gosh.
Remember that?
Yes.
Yes.
Out of the past.
Yeah. So like there's been two or three milestone moments where Serena has just gotten.
Well, since we're on women's tennis, I had the pleasure last year of seeing Billie Jean King speak at an event down in California. She's an amazing speaker. It was really fantastic. Very inspiring.
Was that just a name drop or did you have something more to say?
Well, you're talking about you dropped Jennifer Capriati. I was like, if you're going to drop Jennifer Capriati, I'm going to drop somebody a little more substantial in women's tennis history.
What are you saying about Jennifer Capriati? She was amazing. She was a fantastic player. Okay, Billie Jean King.
We're talking about women's liberation here.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I understand.
She basically got women paid an equal amount in tennis. There wouldn't be women's tennis today, Todd, if there would be no Jennifer Capriati if there wasn't Billie Jean King.
Yes,
come on.
Yes, in fact, you are still listening to GeekWire.
That's right. Can we move off the Random Channel?
Yes, all right. It is time to end the show. Thanks for sticking with us. The Random Channel is always truly random. Monica Nicholsberg, John Cook, this has been fun. Until next time, I'm Todd Bishop. Thanks both of you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Todd.
Okay. You can find out much more at geekwire.com. Bye, everybody.